I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is the Takeaway for October 8th. The United States and China are headed back to the negotiating table on Thursday. Is an end to the trade war finally in sight?
It's not a trade negotiation. It's really a negotiation about bringing about a fundamental change in communist countries' state capitalism.
Peter Navarro, assistant to the president on trade, joins us to discuss. Plus, the U.S. government is paying nearly $13 million per detainee in Guantanamo Bay, making the site one of the most expensive prisons in the world.
They built it out of reach of the American people, out of reach of the American courts, and then they put this prison down there and decided to bring to the prison anything that they needed to make it function.
Plus, how the NBA struggles to balance its woke reputation with its expanding Chinese market, with Sopan Deb of the New York Times. Lots to get to, so let's hit it. On Thursday, trade talks are set to resume between the U.S. and China as a trade war between the nations that's lasted more than a year continues. Joining me now from Washington is Peter Navarro, assistant to the president and director of the Office of Trade and Manufacturing Policy. Peter, welcome to The Takeaway.
Great pleasure to be with you, Ms. Vega.
So let's start with the U.S.-Japan trade agreement that the Trump administration released yesterday. It looks like digital protections are pretty strong, and the U.S. beef and pork and cheese industries are coming out as winners. Question for you. All these benefits would have been locked in with the TPP partnership, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Was it worth backing out of that for this deal?
Absolutely. The difference between a bilateral trade deal with Japan and being in the TPP is a huge difference. Here's the problem we had with the TPP. We already had trade agreements with six of the countries within the TPP. The other five countries, Japan comprised over 90% of the GDP. So we really would have had to give away a lot in order to get what we got from Japan, including both our auto and auto parts industry. The deal we got with Japan, we didn't have to do that. So it was really a great victory for President Trump and a great stroke of negotiating by Ambassador Robert Lighthizer.
Well, let's talk a little bit about some of the things that did have to get given away here. There was the U.S. rice industry, propane, semiconductors, and there are currently no protections against currency manipulation. Was it worth it?
This is a great deal with Japan. I'm surprised, actually, that one would question what was one of the great deals that we've struck so far. I mean, to date, we struck the deal with Japan. We have the Canada and Mexico deal on the table, waiting only for Nancy Pelosi to put it on the floor. This president is doing remarkable things. We have China at the negotiating table. It would have been a horrible mistake for the U.S. to enter the Trans-Pacific Partnership. We basically would have had to divide our manufacturing base up between 11 different countries in order to get very modest benefits.
You said, as we mentioned at the top, China and the U.S. are at the negotiating table starting later this week. Trade negotiations are about to resume. What's going to have to happen, Peter, for you to consider these talks a success?
It all begins with what I've referred to as the seven deadly sins, the seven structural problems that we face with China. And for your listeners, it's really important to understand that context. Let me go through them quickly and briefly. You have the cyber hacking of our business computers to steal our trade secrets. You have the intellectual property theft, which costs America the order of several hundred billion dollars a year. Forced technology transfer is a condition if you're an American company and you want market access to China, absolutely against the rules of the World Trade Organization. China massively dumps products below cost into our markets, costs us factories and jobs. They run on state-owned enterprises against American corporations, massively subsidized. That's not fair. Currency manipulation is a huge problem. And one of the things that really is important to President Trump and myself, made in China, fentanyl and other opioids will kill over 100 Americans by this day's end, over 1,000 by the end of this week, and over 50,000 a year. And the Chinese keep promising they're going to handle that. They haven't. So that's the context. We did have a deal with them about 6 months ago on the table to deal with those seven verticals. It would have been a great deal for the world. they backed away from it. So the success metric here is based on that original deal that they reneged on. Let's see where we get to.
Let's talk a little bit about how politics is going to play into this, Peter. I mean, in advance of these talks with China, the president asked China to investigate his political rival, Joe Biden. Do you think that's going to have any effect on what's happening this week?
No.
Well, the House impeachment inquiry, speaking about that, is taking up a lot of the president's bandwidth right now. Do you think China, I mean, can't China just afford to prolong these talks up until the election, the next election?
So there's really two questions there. I think it's a tragedy for this nation for the president to have to take up so much bandwidth, as you refer to it. For me, there's only one question related to impeachment that needs answering, and that's simply this. Are the Democrats trying to overthrow a duly elected president because they can't beat him at the ballot box? I call that the Al Green question, because that's what Congressman Al Green admitted. This is a divisive process. The thing I can tell you, Ms. Vega, being at the White House from day one and going through an earlier witch hunt with the Mueller crisis, is the president stays absolutely focused on the mission, which is to create good jobs at good wages for the American people. We're at 6 million jobs and counting, over 500,000 manufacturing jobs. And we have the lowest unemployment rate since a man walked on the moon. Impeach that.
Well, we're talking with Peter Navarro, assistant to the president. Peter, I want to touch on a number of things you just mentioned here. We'll pivot for a second here to the U.S. economy. You were on CNBC on September 30th, and you were asked specifically about manufacturing. Let's take a listen to what your response was.
I don't even know why you're going down this path. This Trump economy is strong as a rock. Manufacturing is strong as a rock.
So let's break that down. To your point, unemployment has hit a 50-year low here in the United States, but manufacturing in particular, Peter, is not doing so well. The day after you were on CNBC, the Institute for Supply Management Factory Index showed that the manufacturing sector was at its weakest point since the Great Recession. How do you respond?
I look very carefully at the numbers. The biggest problem that we're facing right now is the Federal Reserve's policy on interest rates, which is wildly out of synchronization with the central banks of the rest of the world. When Jerome Powell assumed the chairmanship of the Fed, he began a very aggressive rate hike. Now, what that does for your listeners to understand is that drives up the higher interest rates, then drive up the value of the U.S. dollar. Then a stronger dollar reduces our exports, and that reduces our export growth. And we saw that in the Q2 numbers, where we lost two-thirds of a point of growth. We were down at around 2%, 2.1%, instead of closer to 3%, simply because of those interest rates. The Fed is killing us, and meanwhile, the European Central Bank is lowering their rates faster now than we are lowering ours. So for me, as the director of the Office of Trade and Manufacturing Policy, it's deeply concerning that those interest rates are too high and that the currency, the dollar, is way overvalued relative to what it should be. So, but every day we work on this, and we have created over 500,000 manufacturing jobs, and that's compared to the 200,000 manufacturing jobs lost during the Obama-Biden years.
Last week, however, the Labor Department employment numbers showed that there were 2,000 jobs lost in manufacturing for September. How do you respond to those? How do you explain those losses?
2,000 jobs in a how many people in the workforce? Over 100 million in the workforce? That's not a big number, I would say. I think that the important thing is here in the Trump economy that everyone who wants a job can get a job. Everybody who wants to look for a better job has the option to do that. Wages are rising, and I am continually puzzled by people wringing their hands over issues of recession or complaining about this or complaining about that, when we have historically low unemployment rates for blacks, for Hispanics, for women, for veterans, for the disabled. And You know, my job is to get up every day and try to create jobs for the working men and women who work with their hands. President does the same thing, except he's also got to worry about national security, border security, and other things.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that, because there's a lot to unpack there. On Friday's job report, it showed that wage growth here has slowed. The U.S., the conservative U.S. Chamber of Commerce, in fact, has called for an end to the trade war with China. And you've got financial institutions like Goldman Sachs and Bank of America who say that this is sort of stalling the U.S. economy. Are they wrong? And how do you respond to the slowing wage growth?
They are wrong. The nomenclature of this so-called trade war with China, as I spoke earlier about the seven deadly sins, it's not really about a trade war. A trade war is something you can settle, say, with Japan or Mexico or Canada, where they lower their tariffs and we lower ours. The China problem is the theft of intellectual property, the forced technology transfer, the hacking of our computers, the currency manipulations. It's not a trade negotiation. It's really a negotiation about bringing about a fundamental change in a communist country's state capitalism, which really is unfair to the rest of the world. So, that's what this is about. When I hear Goldman Sachs or Wall Street or the Business Roundtable, those are the people who supported the offshoring of American jobs for the last 20 years. So I don't find that they have a credibility. Over 500,000 manufacturing jobs President Trump has created. And when he was campaigning, everybody said that manufacturing was dead and that would never happen. This is truly a Trump miracle. And, this week I'll be in Philadelphia at the Philadelphia shipyard trying to rejuvenate that shipyard. I've been to Marinette, Wisconsin, where they're building littoral
combat
ships.
I just want to get, we're coming at the end of the segment. Sure. I just want to make sure we get in a question about aid in particular. There are the farmers in particular. The president has said he supports this group of workers in particular, and they've received $28 billion in farm aid over the past 2 years, and their soybean exports have been cut significantly since this quote-unquote trade war has begun. How do you respond to that?
Look, here's my final word. President Trump has the back of the farmers, but listen to the signal, ignore the noise. President Trump stands up to China. He creates jobs, secures our borders, and he gets us out of foreign wars. That's the signal received loud and clear by the Trump base, and it's called America. So just ignore the noise and see
a little bit more noise for you before we let you go, Peter. You mentioned NAFTA's replacement, USMCA. It still needs congressional approval. Got about 30 seconds left. Do you expect the impeachment inquiry to affect chances of its passage?
Nancy Pelosi has a choice. She's got a choice, partisan politics or prosperity for the country. It's a one-person choice, so she's got to make that. And whether impeachment affects that, it's going to be on her own conscience.
Peter Navarro is an assistant to the president and the director of the Office of Trade and Manufacturing Policy. Peter, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
To help us break down the effects of the Trump administration's trade policy with China, I'm joined by Alex Lawson, editor-at-large at Law 360. Alex, welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much, Tanzina.
So you heard our conversation with Peter Navarro and about the Trump administration's policy on tariffs. Any specific points that you'd like to respond to, clarify?
Yeah, I thought it was interesting that when you pressed him about the fact that manufacturing has contracted to its lowest point in just about a decade, he quickly pivoted to placing blame on the Federal Reserve and its reluctance to do a rate cut. That's a fair enough point, I suppose. But I think it's worth noting that in that study that you cited to him specifically, the actual manufacturers who were interviewed for it cited the tariffs and the proliferation of those tariffs as a reason for why they have contracted, why their output is lower than it is. So, I mean, it's not as though we can just glide past this, pretend it's not having an effect. It is. The administration has tried to sort of blunt the effect of the tariffs in choosing which products they apply to and rolling them out in a strategic way. But it's very clear that it's having an impact.
So We're heading into talks on Thursday. U.S. and China are back at the negotiating table. Are you expecting anything different to come out of these talks?
It's tough to say. I mean, we've been at this for just about 2 years now, and all that there is to show for it is, you know, a tariff on basically every single U.S. product going to China and about 70% of Chinese products coming into the U.S. with tariffs. And at every stage, it's been, you know, a couple steps forward and maybe a couple steps back. They were sort of sounding optimistic heading into this round, Until some concrete progress is made, I don't think that there's any reason to think that it actually will. Both governments have made clear that they are willing to sort of go to the hilt on tariffs and even going beyond tariffs in terms of trade restrictions, which we can talk about a little bit if you like.
But. Yeah, I want to get to trade in a minute, but the president postponed the tariffs that were supposed to go into effect right now before the holidays. Mm-hmm. But are we expecting Christmas tariffs? And could that turn the tide and change public opinion about what's happening?
That's sort of the big that's the next big looming monolith here, which is that there's a tariff hike that's supposed to go into effect on October 15th. That those are existing tariffs that are going to go from, I believe, 25% to 30%. But the next thing that's really looming is this December 15th tariff hit that you're talking about. And this is sort of this is like really been considered the third rail of this entire thing, because as I indicated before, the U.S. has for the most part tried to just keep tariffs, you know, applied to like industrial goods, things that are used to make other things. They've tried their best to avoid them on consumer products. With a few exceptions. But the ones that are supposed to take place in December without some other delay, which could happen, are things like laptops, televisions, toys, clothing, things that you and I buy that we are therefore more likely to feel the price effects of. Until now, you know, when you're a little bit up the supply chain on some piece of steel that's used to make some other thing, you know, businesses can hide the ball a little bit in terms of how they're raising prices. But when it gets down to, you know, actual expensive consumer goods that you and I buy, it's definitely possible that the prices could be going up significantly.
We asked Peter Navarro about the Trump administration's authorization to billions of dollars in aid for U.S. farmers that are apparently, you know, they're needing this after the tariffs.
Right.
And how well is that aid package working out for farmers, and how is it playing out politically?
Yeah, I mean, it's important to note that came about because it's not just the U.S. tariffs that exist in isolation. China has responded in kind, and that has an outsized effect on the agricultural sector. So just putting that out there. The sort of reports that you hear from farm country are somewhat scattershot, where it's like, well, we certainly appreciate that the government is going to give us money to blunt the effect of this trade skirmish they've gotten into. But like any government program, there are reports that this stuff isn't quite getting there on time. There's a long bureaucratic process to go through. There was a report, I believe, in Bloomberg that the U.S. has paid something like $1 million in interest for late payments on these things, because so it's taking time to filter down. And almost to a person, even the farmers who are interviewed who appreciate the help, almost to a person, they almost always say, this is nice, but we would much rather not have to like depend on the government for payments that may or may not come at some later defined date. We would just like to be able to trade as we were before. And that is, we're not really close to that happening anytime soon.
We also asked Peter Navarro about this issue. The economy has been strong for the past few years, but we have a slowing bond market. Economists are warning of the risk of a recession in the future, partly because of this trade war. Mm-hmm. What could happen to the economy if that happens and if tariffs continue to rise?
It's very tricky. I mean, you never... The sort of economist party line is like, you know, tariffs will never cause a recession, but it's definitely not going to help you. And I think it's pretty clear. I mean, the sort of advance indicators, the reason the overall strength of the economy is part of the reason that we've been able to weather this storm for a little bit. But I mean, like as you say, the advance indicators are not looking so well. And like I said before, they've not been shy about going all the way to the hilt on these tariffs. And yeah, I mean, you could if the economy turns, this will be sort of a main culprit, not the culprit, but certainly one of them.
We got about a minute left in the segment here. I mean, what are you expecting from China to really put their foot down on these trade negotiations even harder than they have in the past?
Well, you hinted at it in your interview with Peter. It's very possible that they might just want to wait out the Trump administration, wait till the election, hope for a regime change and just kind of roll the dice. Worth noting that Trump himself has said that if he wins a second term and this process is still going on, he's going to adopt a much tougher negotiating posture, which would take us beyond tariffs. And then we're into investment restrictions, national security, delistings, blacklistings. That's been happening in the telecom space already. So we'll just have to see.
Alex Lawson is editor-at-large at Law 360 and a co-host of the Pro Se podcast. Alex, thanks so much.
Thanks so much, Danzy.
Hi, this is Irene from Valley Stream. Trump has handled the U.S.-China relationship masterfully. Just kidding. He has accelerated the decline of U.S. economic and diplomatic power in the world. New trade relationships will emerge from Trump's tariff fight, and the U.S. will no longer be the indispensable nation. China will be in a stronger position after Trump's presidency.
This is John from Farmingdale, New York. I have mixed feelings about Trump's handling of China. He has one good point, and that is that we need to stop China from stealing our intellectual property. His misunderstanding of tariffs has hurt many sectors of our economy.
Hi, this is Mike calling from Dover Plains, New York. In regard to Trump and his handling of the U.S.-China relationship, can sum it up in one word: debacle. He had taken a not-so-good situation and made it into a deplorable one.
Earlier this year, in August, a military judge finally announced the date for the trial involving five people detained in Guantanamo, allegedly involved in the September 11th attacks. The trial is set for January 11th, 2021. One of the five who will be tried is Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the alleged mastermind of the 9/11 attacks. But during the pretrial preparations, the New York Times was able to calculate how expensive Guantanamo really is. For every detainee, the U.S. government is spending $13 million a year, and there are currently 40 people detained. We're now joined by Carol Rosenberg, Guantanamo reporter for the New York Times, and she's here to help us understand where exactly all that money is going. Carol, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you, Tanzina.
So, as you've written, the amount of manpower and costs that are applied at Guantanamo are tremendous. What does that mean, and how does Guantanamo differ from a big prison here in the United States, for example?
Well, I think the most significant reason why it is so very expensive is because of its location. You know, they built it out of reach of the American people, out of reach of the American courts, and then they put this prison down there and decided to bring to the prison anything that they needed to make it function. So it starts off with everything that arrives to support that prison coming on a barge or an airplane. That includes fruit and vegetables that arrive on a weekly refrigerator flight and twice monthly barge that arrive from Florida that bring everything from cars to building supplies to anything that that base may need. The other reason why it's so very expensive is because it's staffed by 1,800 soldiers and about 300 contractors, civilian employees of the Pentagon. They staff with National Guard and Reserve troops that are pulled from across the country into these nine-month positions down there. And we learned in the process of reporting the story that it costs about $100,000 per soldier per year to keep them at Guantanamo.
Carol, what else is at Guantanamo other than the detention center itself?
Well, Guantanamo itself is a base. It's a little small town on the edge of, you know, in the Caribbean, in southeast Cuba, behind a minefield. The U.S. has been there for more than 100 years. They set it up like a little town. It has an airport and a seaport. And aside from the 2,200 or so people who are working for or responsible to the prison, there's another 4,000 people who live there. Sailors, workers, sailors' families, school teachers, the people who run the scuba diving and cinemas and the bars and all of the things that people do on this little small town when they're not working. So it's basically a small town with a prison on one end, a court on the other, and a McDonald's in the middle.
Let's talk a little bit about some of the revelations we've heard on the 9/11 trial reparations. Is the January 2021 date for the trial firm, or is there a possibility that it could be pushed even further back?
The judge has set a timetable of things that have to happen before January 11th, 2021, for that day to start jury selection. You know, the jury is going to be military officers brought in from around the world to be chosen for this trial, which the judge envisions is lasting 9 months. But before they ever get to jury selection, there's a whole series of legal motions that have to be argued. He has to make a series of decisions about what evidence may or may not be used at trial. The government, the prosecution, and the Pentagon have to come in and tell him basically how this little tiny base in the middle of nowhere is going to be able to handle a trial of this magnitude. He wants to know where people are going to sleep, how they're going to eat, where they're going to work, how they're going to arrive, how the jury will be sequestered. And then legally, the defense lawyers are still arguing that some of the key evidence that the prosecution want to use at this trial is inadmissible. And this judge has yet to decide whether or not he's going to allow, for example, the things they said when they first came to Guantanamo from 3 and 4 years in the black sites, where they were treated just, I mean, they call it torture, but it was a systematic isolation of individuals who were broken through violence and psychological manipulation. What went on in the black sites is front and center in the lead up to this trial, and whether what anything that these men came to say after they got to Guantanamo from this treatment could be admissible as trial as voluntary statements.
Carol, what changes have we seen, particularly when it comes to judges and attorneys in this trial?
You know, we were talking about how it's not ready for prime time. This is a new judge. He's been on for a couple of months. He started in the summer, and one of the things that he wants them to figure out is if they bring all these people down and they start this trial, how is healthcare going to work? And it's a real valid question, because earlier this year, his predecessor, a Marine colonel who was the judge on the case, suffered a detaching retina while he was at Gitmo and required emergency healthcare in Miami. And the base arranged to medevac him, and the medevac didn't show up for something like 16 hours. And so there are just basic fundamental services that have to be in place before they start bringing down not just juries, but elderly family members of the 9/11 families who want to watch these proceedings, witnesses who may not be in the best of health care, and this constant flow of people coming to the base. A lot has to happen for this trial to actually start with jury selection on January 11th, 2021.
And finally, who's representing the defendants in this case?
You know, it's interesting. We, the American people, are paying the bill for all the defense attorneys. Under the law that created the war court, the military commissions, the Pentagon hires the defense attorneys. And since this is a capital case, the prosecution is seeking the death penalty for Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and the four other men accused of putting together the plot and assisting the hijackers who killed 2,976 people on September 11th, 2001. Since it's a death penalty case, the Pentagon is required to hire what they call learned counsel, capital defense attorneys, people with experience defending in capital cases. So in the instance of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, we recently saw a change, and a man who had defended the Unabomber, Ted Kaczynski, in his capital case, is now the lead capital defense counsel for the lead defendant, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, all paid by the U.S. taxpayers.
Carol Rosenberg is the Guantanamo reporter for the New York Times. Carol, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
We return now to where we started this hour, in China. But this time, we're not talking trade, we're talking basketball. The NBA's relationship with China quickly turned sour this weekend after the general manager of the Houston Rockets, Daryl Morey, tweeted his support of pro-democracy protests in Hong Kong. Mori deleted his tweet almost immediately and responded to fans in China, but it was too late. Chinese businesses, sports leagues, and broadcasters have said that they will suspend ties with the Rockets. And today, China sent further warning shots, suspending broadcasts of preseason games for at least a week and canceling a planned visit by the Brooklyn Nets to a school in Shanghai. On Monday, the NBA released a statement saying it was, quote, regrettable that Mori's tweet offended so many Chinese fans, and that led Republican and Democratic lawmakers to accuse the league of prioritizing money over human rights, democracy, and free speech. NBA Commissioner Adam Silver then issued a longer statement acknowledging that outrage, saying, quote, for those who question our motivation, this is about far more than growing our business. Joining me now to talk about all this is New York Times reporter Sopan Deb. Sopan, thanks so much for being with The Takeaway.
Thank you so much for having me.
So let's take a step back here. How much power does China have over the NBA?
Well, we're finding out quite a bit, right? I mean, this is one of the most interesting situations we've seen in years. Let's unpack this a little bit, which is that the NBA has made going international a key pillar of its mission over the next couple of years. You might have heard that the NBA recently played preseason games in India. They, in partnership, have announced a league in Africa. China has been the crown jewel of that expansion plan going back decades. So essentially, this is a very, very notable controversy because the NBA essentially has billions of dollars. I don't know about billions, but certainly
a lot
of money. Mm-hmm. I think at least a billion tied up in China. So this is a huge, huge deal that might affect the NBA's financial interest for sure.
So what do we know about why Mori deleted the tweet? What prompted that?
We don't know. Daryl Morey hasn't said anything publicly at this point. I will say part of what happened is Daryl Morey sends out the tweet, and within hours, his own owner, Tillman Fertitta, sends a quote tweets him and says, Daryl Morey does not speak for the Houston Rockets, and this is not a political organization. I would also note, though, in saying that, Tillman Fertitta is a very open Donald Trump supporter, and he has been very open in talking about it. So they are a political they're not a political organization except when they are, right? So so that's why Mori deleted the tweet. We also don't know what prompted him to do that. Was he asked to do that? We don't know that at this point. He hasn't said that publicly.
So speaking of the team here, the Rockets, one of their star players, James Harden, apologized for Maury's tweet on Monday and while standing next to his teammate, Russell Westbrook. Let's take a listen to what Harden had to say.
You know, we love China. We love, you know, playing there. I know for both of us individually, we go there, you know, once or twice a year. They show us the most important love. So, you know, we appreciate them as a fan base, and we love everything, you know, they're about. And you know, we appreciate their support that they give us.
Is Harden doing damage control there, or what was his point there?
What's particularly fascinating is James Harden is the only party involved here who has said sorry. Daryl Morey did not apologize. What he said in his statement was, you know, that he regretted the reaction. And essentially, the NBA said the same thing, is that they regretted the backlash, but they never actually apologized for what Daryl Morey said. James Harden is the one who came out and said, we apologize to China. But remember, again, back up here, NBA players, especially superstars, they have a lot of money tied up in China, whether it's in shoe sponsorships, whether it's in Nike doing events there, all that kind of stuff. So for players, there's a real incentive for them to not alienate a huge, huge international market for the NBA.
A lot of the political backlash here, and we'll talk a little bit about some specifics, but a lot of it has sort of been involved in how woke, quote unquote, the NBA really is.
Sure.
And, you know, I recall, you know, some players were wearing T-shirts, LeBron James among them, talking about, you know, things like Black Lives Matter. And so is this new for the NBA, especially at an international level, just being involved in this whole free speech debate at the international level?
Well, I certainly cannot think of a situation where something like this has come up. The NBA has very publicly pushed the brand that they are an activist league that encourages activism. And you saw that kind of recently. LeBron James is a very, you know, a decently active athlete, but LeBron James was key in getting the California bill passed about paying college athletes, right? Whether it's, especially with when it comes to police shootings, NBA players have been very vocal. Last year, Vivek Ranadive, the owner of the Sacramento Kings, came out and said, addressed Black Lives Matter protesters that had disrupted the game and said, you know, we want to help you. We want to make sure a tragedy like this never happens again, referring to a fatal police shooting that occurred in the Sacramento area. So, yes, the NBA has theoretically been more, let's say, allowing of its players and its figures to speak about politics. However, none of the situations that they've talked about so far have ever impacted the NBA's bottom line. And at the end of the day, the NBA is a corporation, and the NBA is well aware of what its brand is. And anything that affects that brand is going to be considered here. And this is a case where the NBA's initial statement was roundly condemned. You know, Adam Silver's talked about the NBA being a unifying force. And here is a case where Ted Cruz, Elizabeth Warren, you know, Beto O'Rourke, Rick Scott, all these Marco Rubio, you know, they're all suddenly getting on the same page to say the NBA really screwed up here. And you know, free speech is really worth something until it affects the NBA's bottom line, essentially what the message is from the critics. And so I'm not sure that the NBA can necessarily hold the mantle of being, you know, the politically active league. Now, with that being said, Adam Silver held a press conference today in Tokyo where he was a little bit more forceful in standing behind Daryl Morey and saying, look, we believe in the right to free expression. We're going to protect our employees' right to free expression. Again, we regret the backlash that it caused, but, you know, these are our values and this is what we stand for.
It's amazing if the NBA could be the thing that unites us politically here. I mean, you know, quite frankly, I was going to ask you about Silver. I mean, he said, you know, quote, for those who question our motivation, this is about far more than growing our business. I mean, that doesn't seem realistic. I mean, is it about more than growing their business, or has he kind of walked that back with this statement you mentioned in Tokyo?
Well, Tanzina, you and I have both been journalists for a little while. Do you know many corporations that are so much more than being a business? I mean,
aren't they people? I just want to check.
I mean, at the end of the day, the NBA, here's the other thing is that the NBA has been rapidly growing in the last couple of years. It's really risen in popularity in part because of the activism of its players. Also, the quality of play has improved on the court. You have a lot of really marketable stars. And to alienate one of their biggest markets in China is really difficult. I think it's a difficult prospect for the NBA, who is looking at revenue numbers, right? They're looking at that. On top of all this, the new owner of the Brooklyn Nets is a guy named Joe Tsai, who made a lot of his money in China, you know, as a co-founder of Alibaba. So he releases a statement Sunday night that calls the Hong Kong protesters a separatist movement and says Daryl Morey's tweet was damaging. And so remember that Adam Silver works for the owners. He works for these 30 owners, and that's whose interests he has to kind of protect here. And so here's Joe Tsai that comes in and says, well, Daryl Morey's tweet was damaging, and the Hong Kong protesters are a separatist movement. And so he's got to manage all these different kind of parties here between American politicians. You know, I think there was a senator, I think Josh Hawley, who called on a meeting with Silver and called him to cancel the exhibition games.
Jeez. A lot of money here.
And then there's the Yao Ming. So Yao Ming is the president of the Chinese Basketball Association. And as Silver said today, that he's very incensed. Adam Silver, in some ways, is very much caught between a rock and a hard place here. I'll say it that way.
It's a fascinating story, and I appreciate you bringing it to us. Sopan Deb is a reporter for The New York Times. Thank you, Sopan.
Thank you so much for having me.
And that's our show for today. If you have any thoughts for us, you can give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE, or you can reach us on Twitter at The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway, and thanks so much for listening.